Well, we're going to start looking at Mark's Gospel this morning. For the moment, I just want to read Mark chapter 1, verse 1. Mark 1, verse 1. We're going to try and unpack a bit about why Mark starts his Gospel the way he does. Mark 1, verse 1, Mark simply says this: "The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, what does it mean to be a Christian? Well, Christianity isn't just a philosophy, a way of thinking. It's not just a set of rules. There are rules, there are commands to obey, but it can't be reduced to that. It's not simply a tradition, although people clearly are brought up in a traditional Christian upbringing at times. Christianity, at its heart, is faith, and faith not in a system, but in a person. It's a living relationship through faith in an individual, in Jesus Christ himself. It's a relationship through faith. Now, in Mark's Gospel, Mark takes us on a journey of faith, and that's the journey I want to invite you to join us on today. That journey that starts, at least for our church today, as we read through Mark's Gospel. And it could be as we read through it that you're coming face to face with him for the first time, or at least the first time in a direct, personal way. Be that you've read things, you've heard all sorts of things about him before, but now you're meeting him face to face, personally. And it could be that you've known Jesus for a long time, for many years, but this is, as we read through Mark, this is our opportunity for our faith, our admiration, our love for him to deepen as we discover him afresh. Why read the Gospel of Mark? Well, because what greater subject could there be for us to study than Jesus Christ himself? What sort of letter is Mark? What sort of book is Mark? It's not a letter. It's not a prophecy. You might think biography, but actually it's not a biography either, because normally in a biography, they're trying to tell you about everything in their lives. Mark zooms in on just one section of Jesus' life, really, if you consider how many years he lived for. The purpose of Mark is what we read in that opening verse. He calls it a gospel. We well know the word gospel means good news, but it was used in all sorts of contexts. It was used by armies when they'd won a battle, they'd won the victory, their messengers would come back and they would announce the gospel. The good news, we won the war. It was the term used to announce Caesar Augustus's birthday. The gospel. Now, see, to us, gospel immediately has religious overtones. It didn't necessarily back then. But sometimes it did. It's a word that comes up in the Old Testament. Older translations use the term glad tidings. Well, actually, glad tidings is the same as gospel. It's the same word, it's the same meaning. Mark here says, good news. It's the good news of Jesus, the Son of God. And then everything in this book is directed towards telling us about that good news. Now, what gives Mark the right to tell us this story? Well, what do we know about Mark? You read about Mark in Acts chapter 12. Acts 12, verse 12, we're told that he was brought up by a believing woman, his mother, called Mary. Mark there is referred to as John Mark in Acts 12, verse 12. The church met at his mother's house to pray, so he had that sort of upbringing. And then you find him in Acts 12, 25, Acts 13 verse 5, where this John Mark becomes Paul and Barnabas's assistant, sort of like a junior supporter. He's brought along on these missionary journeys with Paul and Barnabas. But John Mark, the writer of this gospel, also has some real failures as a disciple. The first one comes, at least the first one we know about, comes Acts 15 verses 36 to 38. Paul and Barnabas have taken him on this journey, but they have a sharp disagreement between Paul and Barnabas as to whether to take him on the next journey or not. We don't know what Mark has done, but obviously he's done something that means Paul thinks we can't bring someone like him. He's proved himself unworthy, untrustworthy, unfaithful in some way. Paul feels like this guy's let the Sally down. We can't bring him with us again. But then secondly, Mark 14 verse 51, Jesus there is led away from the Garden of Gethsemane, and we're told this, Mark 14, 51, a certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body, and the young men laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. That's probably Mark. He's cowardly, running away. The shame of being naked in public is less than the shame of being seen following Jesus. He runs away. Two great failures in this man's life, or at least two that we know of. I'm sure there were more. You know, often we find a certain sort of kinship in others who have had similar experiences. So here's a question. In fact, here's a question for children. Children, I suppose by children I mean boys on the front row. If Mark was a coward and failed as a believer sometimes, which one of Jesus' disciples do you think he might have had most in common with? Can you think of another disciple who was cowardly and failed and let Jesus down? Go on.
Peter.
Yeah, he would have had a lot in common with Peter because of those sorts of experiences we've read about. Probably had most in common with him. And what's interesting is that's what you find in the Bible. So if you were to look at 1 Peter 5 verse 13, Peter is writing his letter and it's very clear he's with Mark as he's writing. He talks about Mark and he refers to Mark as my son. Peter seems to have taken Mark under his wing, cared for him, helped him. You know, we don't know what the conversations were. Does he work through these failures that Mark's had? Because Peter's had to work through those sorts of things. He had to come to terms with how he let his saviour down. But Peter does go on to be a leader, an apostle, and so on. And, well, Mark's had to do the same sort of thing with the ways he's failed as a believer. Now, all the early Christian writers after the apostles, they all say the same thing. They all say Mark is Peter's man. He's Peter's right-hand man. So Mark's gospel is Mark's written account of Peter's experience as a disciple. In fact, it's interesting, when you compare Peter's sermons he preaches in Acts, they follow a very similar layout to the layout of the book of Mark. It does stack up. It makes sense that Mark was seeing what it means to be a disciple through Peter's eyes in this book. So that's why some of Peter's supposed exploits, like walking on the water, they're not in there. But what you do have is loads of accounts where Peter comes across as not a very good disciple of Jesus. Even in the one we just read in the Transfiguration, Peter's the one who doesn't get it. He doesn't know what to say. So he says, well, look, let's make these three tabernacles for the three of you. It's Mark that makes a lot of Peter's denials of Christ. It's because when Peter tells this story, the way he wants to tell it is, I'm a failure, but Christ is wonderful. So that's the view of Peter you get through Mark. And it also explains as well why the book of Mark is so full of action. It's one thing we're going to discover, I hope, as we go through this. You read the Gospel of John, there are these long sections of Jesus' teaching. Or in Matthew, you've got the Sermon on the Mount. In Mark, it's just action, one story after another, quickly moving on. In chapter 1, chapter 2, he says, immediately this, immediately that. He uses the word immediately lots of times. The pace moves swiftly on. And then one more question before we get into the main section of this sermon. Who's Mark writing for? He's writing for Gentiles. Mark doesn't give a lot of the Jewish background. So you look at Matthew and Luke, they start with the birth narratives. They start with the history. They trace Jesus's ancestry back because that's very important. Mark doesn't do that. And Mark frequently translates Aramaic phrases into either Latin or Greek. He does that lots of times. He translates the words. And most people, in fact, all the early church writers said he was writing to believers in Rome. And that seems a likely scenario. And we'll come back to that later, because it's interesting, if you bear that in mind, where a certain Roman person comes up in Mark. So, what's the book of Mark all about? I want to give it to you in one sentence. Mark is the story of the unveiling of Jesus Christ as the Son of God. It's the story of how he was unveiled to the disciples and to other people. And there are three pivotal events I want us to think about this morning in which Jesus is gradually unveiled to be the Son of God. Notice in Mark 1 verse 1, that's how he talks about him. How does Mark want us to view him? He's Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So three pivotal events. Firstly, if you look at Mark chapter 1, verses 9 to 11, you've got Jesus' baptism. So that's the first pivotal event. Mark 1, verses 9 to 11, Jesus goes to John the Baptist, and he wants to be baptized. He's baptized by John in the Jordan. And it says immediately, notice that word immediately, coming up from the water, he saw the heavens parting and the Spirit descending upon him like a dove. And this is Mark 1 verse 11. Then a voice came from heaven, "You are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." Who was there when Jesus was baptized? When you look at all four of the gospel accounts, we're not told about anyone else who was there apart from John the Baptist and Jesus. It's interesting, John the Baptist, he says this in John chapter 1, verse 33. John the Baptist says, "I didn't know who Jesus was until he was baptized." Until the moment happened where the heaven broke open and the voice spoke out of heaven and said, "This is my beloved Son." Until that happened, John says, "I didn't know who he was." So what's happening at Jesus' baptism is John the Baptist's eyes are being opened. And what is it that John the Baptist needs to know? What is it that the voice from heaven says? "Jesus, this is my Son. This is the Son of God." So who knows at this point the true identity of Jesus Christ? John the Baptist does. That's who knows about Jesus. That's the first pivotal event. We're trying to build a picture here. Secondly, you go several chapters on into Mark chapters 8 and 9. Jesus by this point has been working miracles, he's taught parables, he's had various disputes with the Pharisees. But if we go to the account of the blind man being brought to Jesus. So Mark 8, verses 22 to 26. It's this account where Jesus spits on this blind man's eyes, puts his hand on him, and says, "Do you see anything?" He says, "I see men like trees walking." In other words, if he looks over there, he can see the general outline of a human, but it looks like a tree walking. I can see a general shape, and it's tall and thin, but that's about it. You know, it's a bit like if I take my glasses off, I can still tell that it's Terry over there in the corner, but all I can see of his face is, no offence Terry, blotchy, pink, sort of white skin, that's all. I can't see your glasses, I can't see if he's smiling or frowning or whatever else at me. All I can see is a general shape over in the corner. That's what this man can see now. But then Jesus puts his hand on him again, verse 25, and this time he sees clearly. What's the purpose of that miracle? Why does Jesus do that miracle? Well, he's teaching his disciples about their level of understanding. Spiritually speaking, when they look at Jesus, they see the general shape. There's some things they've got in place, but they haven't got the detail yet. They haven't got it all figured out. They started off blind. They're now sort of halfway along. They can see something, but they don't see clearly yet. And maybe that's where you'd say you are in thinking about Jesus. You can see he's impressive, he's intriguing, he's fascinating. But you couldn't say, I know him personally as my friend. Well, that's why Mark wants us to take this journey and come to know him, find our eyes opened to know him for ourselves. You carry on through Mark chapter 8. Verse 27, Jesus asks the disciples this question, who do men say that I am? And the answer is, well, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, some say one of the prophets. And then he drops the killer question, who do you say that I am? And who answers it? It's Peter. Interesting, isn't it? Peter's there. And he says, you are the Christ. And as you read that, you think, great, he's got it. His eyes are open. He finally sees things clearly. He knows that Jesus is the Christ, the Saviour, the Messiah. You think he's got it sorted out. And then Jesus starts to teach in verse 31 about the nature of what it means to be the Christ. What does it mean that Jesus is going to be the Saviour of the world? He says, I'm going to suffer. I'm going to be rejected. I'm going to be killed. And then I'm going to rise again 3 days later. Notice Peter's response in verse 32. He starts to rebuke Jesus. I mean, you read this and think, well, the audacity of it, amazing. But Peter just thinks, no, Jesus, you've got this all wrong. You're the Christ, but what it means to be the Christ is you're going to rule. You're going to be the king. You're going to overthrow the Romans. No, Jesus, you've got this wrong. Peter still isn't seeing things clearly. So you carry on into chapter 9 and verse 2. It's 6 days later. Jesus takes just his inner circle of Peter, James and John up onto a high mountain, and he's transfigured. So we read in verse 3, his clothes are shining. They're white like snow. He's pure. He's beautiful. He's holy. And they hear a voice. Chapter 9, verse 7. What does the voice say? How does God the Father identify this shining figure? He says the same thing he says to John the Baptist. This is my beloved son. Hear him. Because Peter hasn't been listening. Peter had his own preconceived ideas about who Jesus was and what Jesus was meant to be doing with his life. And Peter's been sort of told, you put those things to one side. You put your own ideas over there. And actually, that's something we all have to do when we come to Jesus. We've got to say, actually, Jesus knows best, not me. Bigger picture here, though. The net has widened. Who now is being let in on the secret about the identity of God's Son? It's no longer just John the Baptist. Now, this inner circle, Peter, James and John, the disciples, they're being told, this is my son, this is the Son of God too. And this is a pivotal point in Mark's gospel. From this point onwards, Jesus starts to teach more about the cross. He leaves Galilee and he starts heading towards Jerusalem. He's deliberately going to the place he knows he's going to die. So that's the second scene, the transfiguration. So about Jesus' baptism, we've had Jesus' transfiguration, and we've heard the same words being said at both. Thirdly, I want to take you to a scene at the cross in Mark 15, verse 39. Mark 15, verse 39. Jesus has been tried, arrested, beaten, mocked, and now he's being crucified. He cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? He cries out again with a loud voice. And when you compare this with John's gospel, you can work out that what he's crying there is, it is finished. And then he voluntarily gives up his life. It's a loud cry because it's not that he is being defeated. It's a loud cry when he says it is finished because he's choosing to give up his life. We're told the curtain in the temple rips in two from top to bottom. And as all this happens, Mark 15, verse 39, there's a centurion standing there. And it says, when he saw that he cried out like this, so the manner in which he's crying out at this point, that final cry, and when he sees how this all happens, how he breathes his last, he says, truly this man was the Son of God. This is a Roman officer, a centurion, someone in charge of 100 men, in charge of the soldiers who have just been carrying out their duty, striking Jesus on the head, spitting at him, putting the crown of thorns on him, mocking him. And this centurion has watched everything that's happened. And when he sees how Jesus dies, the voluntary nature of it, the triumph, the victory of saying, it is finished, the work is done, what does he say? Truly this man was the Son of God. Now, can you see the common strand that links all these things together that we're looking at? Why we're picking out these particular pivotal events? Mark 1 verse 1, what does Mark tell us about Jesus there? He's the Son of God. At Jesus' baptism, what does the voice from heaven say? He's the Son of God. This is my Son. What does the voice of the Transfiguration say? This is the Son of God. At this point, though, until the centurion speaks, no human being has made that profession of faith. No man or woman, no human has yet said the words, this is the Son of God. So who's the first person to do it in Mark's gospel? It's a Gentile. And not just any Gentile, a Roman Gentile, a centurion, a member of the opposition. You can see some of the significance of that if we're right in saying Mark is writing to believers in Rome. You're going to say, this really is for me. This is for someone like me, you know, a member of the Roman army and part of Roman civilization. I'm sure you know, even if you've got to cast your mind back to your school days, you'll know something about Roman mythology, their gods, their goddesses, Zeus, Apollo, Cupid, you know, the god of love, Valentine's Day being this week and all. There are all sorts of gods and goddesses. And this centurion, if he was a typical Roman, would have believed in all of them before this moment. He's not here adding another god to his pantheon of idols. He's not just adding an extra one into the mix. He doesn't say this is another son of God, like Zeus. You know, this is the Son of God. And what's something so amazing is that he's saying this having just seen Jesus hanging on a cross, humiliated, suffering, bleeding, dying. It's the complete opposite to the other Roman gods who are known for their strength, their power over nature, their dynamism, their passion. You see the significance of all this for a Roman audience. The secret has been revealed to a Roman centurion, because this is good news for the whole world. Now, there's one final question we've got to ask, and this will have a three-part answer to it as well. I hope you can see why it's important we ask this question. What does the name Son of God mean? I mean, if all we've said, so far we've identified that Jesus is the Son of God, and that's very important for Mark. For Mark, the gospel means Jesus is the Son of God, but what does Son of God mean? What is Jesus claiming for himself when he uses that title? What is the centurion professing to believe when he says this is the Son of God? See, I think when we read our Bibles, when we hear it being read, often we automatically, subconsciously substitute the name Jesus for Son of God. And then we lose some of the richness of what that title means and what it would have meant for the original readers. So, in our culture, to be someone's son, the way we use the word son is we think in physical terms, don't we? If I say, I'm my father's son, well, what I mean is, he produced me physically. That's what I'm talking about. It's one of the reasons that Muslims, when they read this title, Son of God, they find it so repellent, because they think, well, you're saying that God conceived Jesus the Son, physically? This is disgusting. This is unholy. That's not what the name is talking about. And there are three key emphases that will help us understand the name Son of God. We need to bring these three things together. The first one is likeness. Likeness. Now, you could be here this morning, and you could look at Elijah, and you could say, he really is his father's son, isn't he? And when you say something like that, you're not talking about, you know, you don't just literally mean, oh, he is physically descended from his father. You don't mean that, do you? What you mean is, oh, he's the spit of his dad. He looks just like him. Elijah might tell a bad joke, and he might say, he's got his dad's sense of humour, hasn't he? And all you're saying there is, he's like his dad. He's just like his dad. We're not talking biologically here, are we? Adam in the Bible is called God's son. Why is Adam called God's son? Because he bears God's image. Because he's human. Because he's like God in some ways. So to be a son of someone means you are like them. That's why Jesus, when he's speaking, can call people sons of the devil. You are sons of the devil. And what he means isn't anything physical. It's just, you're like him. You think the way he thinks about things. Jesus is the exact divine imprint, the exact divine representation of God. He has the likeness of the Father. That's the first thing. But then we've got to go more than that. We've got to go beyond that to understand the Son of God. And there's an element, there's divinity here too. If you turn back a chapter or two to Mark 14, verse 61. Mark 14, verse 61, Jesus here is being interrogated by the high priest. The Jewish leaders have all been trying to pin things on Jesus. They've come up with various ideas, but none of their testimonies have been able to match. So in Mark 14, 61, the high priest asks this question, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Now, the reason he says the Son of the Blessed is because he doesn't want to say the name God. So he substitutes God with blessed. But what he's really asking is, are you the Son of God? Verse 62, Jesus says, I am. But then what I want you to notice is how the high priest, and in fact everyone else, understands what's being said. Verse 63, the high priest tore his clothes and said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy. This man knows what's being said here. He knows that God is claiming divinity. Jesus is claiming divinity for himself, because that's what the name Son of God means. That's what the high priest knows. For him, as far as he's concerned, I don't need to ask any more questions. Jesus is claiming to be God himself. And then the third strand to what it means to be the Son of God is there's a kingly rule, that he sits on a throne. And for that, we've got to think back to the Old Testament. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, God speaks to King David. And he says, David, I'm going to build a house for you, but not a house built of bricks and stones or anything like that. A house in the sense of dynasty, you know, like we talk about the House of Windsor, where the crown passes down from one generation to the next, from Elizabeth, and it may pass to Charles and so on. You know, the house, in that sense, the House of Windsor, God says, I'm going to build you a house. He says this, I will establish his kingdom, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So God's saying to David, your descendants are going to sit on the throne. They're going to be kings over Israel, just like you are, David. And it's going to be a dynasty that lasts forever, one generation to the next. And he says this about whoever is going to be the king. He says, I will be his father, and he shall be my son. God's saying there, whoever is sitting on the throne of Israel is the Son of God. God's son. That's what he says. I will be his father. He shall be my son. And that will happen with all David's descendants. You know, Solomon, Rehoboam, so on. You can trace the line down. They are rightly called God's son, sitting on his throne, ruling over Israel. And that will happen until one day someone comes who will sit on the throne permanently, who will never die and who will rule forever. So when Jesus is called the Son of God, He's saying, I sit in that chain, that line. I'm the descendant of David. And what that means is, I sit on the throne. I rule over Israel. So let's just bring all those three strands together. Mark wants his readers in Rome, he's probably in Rome, to know that Jesus is the Son of God. And he's telling us this story of how the disciples have come to see this for themselves. And he's inviting us to go through that same process of discovery. So he wants us to see that Jesus is like God, that he has the likeness of God. He wants us to see that he is God. And he wants us to see that he rules as God does. And that's what's going to drive everything that Mark chooses to include or to exclude from his gospel. Why is this his focus? For the simple reason that there's nothing more glorious, more delightful, more impressive, more magnificent than meeting Jesus Christ and seeing him for who he is. Our world measures what's important about a person by their wealth or their intelligence or their family or their social status or their class or their education or what job they do, all those sorts of things. The most important thing about you is what you think of Jesus, who you acknowledge him to be. And you know, one of the big dangers is you see Jesus as a great figure. You know, Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln, someone worthy of respect, someone worth studying. Mark doesn't leave that option open to us. Jesus doesn't leave that option open to us either. The testimony of the centurion and the high priest, everything that's going on in this book, all the accounts, all the people we've met through this story, what John the Baptist said, the voice that speaks from heaven, it all points in one direction. This is not merely a great historical figure. Jesus and everyone else claims him to be the Son of God. That's his own claim. I am God's Son. I am God himself. Mark tells us why all this is such good news as well. So this is the final verse to finish with. Mark 10 verse 45. Why is this gospel? Why is this good news? Mark 10 verse 45. Jesus says, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. This king who sits on the throne of David, who rules in a way that his rule will never ever end, this eternal divine king comes to give his life as a ransom for many. So I hope wherever you are on that journey, if you like, already, if you don't know Jesus personally, you can't say, I know him. There is no topic of greater vitality. There's nothing of greater importance we could be doing on Sunday mornings. There is nowhere better to be than here over the coming months. And if you love him and you know him already, well, the invitation in Mark's gospel is, come and study him afresh. Come and see Jesus in all his glory, the Son of God, as he shines out of this book in his radiance, in his perfection, in his love. Mark's gospel is there to help us worship him and know him better. We're going to sing our final hymn, so along that theme, number 859.